did I get out of it all? And I think what it did for me was cause me to examine my behavior, my motivations, and it drew out qualities in me which may have been present beforehand, but I had an opportunity to express a lot of qualities which actually are inherent in everyone, but you know, there comes a time when you have to express them. But I mean, given the right opportunities, I think the sort of healing qualities and loving care is present with everyone, and that's, people aren't always sure about that about themselves. It may be rather sort of intellectual or unpracticed in a sense. But the thing, obviously, the whole experience and what we're doing now is making me think quite a lot about some of the questions that are raised and the thoughts that I'm having. And there was what was coming up very clearly at the end of the last session and during the break, talking to people, was the sort of roles that we play and how I felt that it was important that Don was treated like an adult and not a child when he was ill. He was given, the space, the respect to handle things in a dignified and mature way. With past experiences with doctors, I've found that I think I've fallen into a childlike role and allowed doctors to have a sort of parent adult type role. I'm a bit more aware of that these days than I used to. It isn't just doctors, I mean, it's educationally, it's our society in general. We fall into hierarchical patterns. And then talking with Barbara just now, it reminded me of, I've been reading, find myself quite interested about addiction, and that some of these roles and substitutions of one's own authority for someone else's or a substance, we actually live in a very addictive society, and that sometimes these roles, reinforce the addiction that's present. So in some ways, I think what was beginning to come up was the psychological games that we play, or roles that we fall into. And Steve, I think you've got much more to talk
about. Well, I was just trying to...
Oh, sorry, wasn't I... Could you hear me? Steve will talk louder.
Steve will talk louder. No, in the sense, what I'm understanding you're saying is that not only the patient is treated by the doctor in a parent or a fatherly way, but in actual fact the patient, something you were saying earlier, Don, can actually adopt the child role. So even if a doctor is standing in front of a patient and saying, I'm not really prepared to do this game with you, sometimes the doctor or the nurse can be thwarted in their attempts because the patient is actually saying, I'm hanging on to this child. I don't know, that was the impression I was getting, particularly when Don was talking about sitting down in the early stages and saying, what sorts of games am I playing with myself till I start presenting, and maybe even giving myself permission to alternate between being an adult and a child, because every now and then I do need to sit down and cry and be a child. I thought it was invaluable.
How far, I may mention what you said then, how far do you think you're able to allow person to be a child for a time?
You
feel that it's necessary sometimes to be able to be a child?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my experience with this overgrown child who I thought was trying to kill me was somehow or another, it was another aspect of my own psyche that was denying the child. access. And so naturally that child aspect of myself was quite cross, I suppose, and thus destructive, as only a child can be when it's cross. And once I was able to accept that child-like thing, I was able to relax and allow the child to participate in my own healing. And that was a major shift, because, again, I'd known about a lot of these things theoretically for years. I mean, I read psychology at university. I'd done a lot over many years of serious and intense reading in these fields. I mean, I had all the answers at an intellectual level, but when it came right down to it, I realized how very little I'd embodied. And once the opportunity to embody these things came in the midst of a crisis like that, then fortunately the intellectual knowledge was there to give it a context and make it sensible to me, so that it hadn't been a complete loss all those years of reading. But yes, I mean, the child has to be allowed, the parent roles have to be allowed, the adult, responsible adult, if one wants to think in sort of transactional analysis terms, role has to be allowed. And there must be something more than that, that in fact controls and allows the shifting, I suppose, what Jung would call the self, or what many people now call the higher self. I don't know what name to give it, but there is a kind of innate intelligence that we have, and that needs to be in charge, and to allow each of these aspects of our personality to have their part in the whole.
Can I interject something?
Yeah.
I'm thinking again about the hospital. One thing that I found was, I don't know if this happens in other hospitals, but they didn't keep their patients in bed any more than was necessary. While patients could walk around, get the bus to the hospital, go out and about, you know, that was encouraged. And afterwards, as soon as the treatment was successful enough for patients to take a more active role, they were encouraged to do so. So they weren't encouraged to be bedridden for any length of time. And I found with Don, just getting him out of the hospital room and into a garden where you could sit in the sunshine and read or do whatever. And as soon as he could go out, we would take a taxi down to the beach, just where you could walk or see something outside the small confines of a hospital room and a ward. And I felt all along that was really important for him to, as soon as he was able to bring his life into a wider context and join the living.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that about the hospital, that there was the freedom to do that, and the understanding that, you know, wherever possible, a person has to be able to get up and do things for themselves rather than be done unto any longer than necessary.
Well, I mean, yes, having moved out of one sort of routine, I mean, an old at-home routine, which had become something of a rut, which, not just a physical rut, but a psychological rut, it would have been very easy to fall into the illness rut and to begin to identify with that role and more, not happily, but somehow contentedly lie there and be a patient for as long as I could. And I remember I loved going out into the sunshine, lying on the grass in that funny little garden, which was about as big as that block of chairs, I suppose, and I just lay on the grass there with my, having dragged my stand and my IV bottle out there with me, and enjoyed the sunshine. The first time we went to the beach, I remember I couldn't walk more than, less than 50 yards, maybe about 30 yards without being exhausted. But I got down in the sand and sat, and then eventually, slowly, each time we did it, I was able to walk a little bit further along the sand. And those sorts of things were amazingly valuable. I suppose if someone's cooped up in a big urban hospital in the midst of a city, it's not so easy to find a place where that can happen. But there always are parks, there are gardens. I mean, it needn't be this sort of weather, although I found that very healing for me.
I think really you've answered part of my question. I was going to ask you something which is divided up into three parts, if I may. One is, could you tell us a little bit about your background? And two, why did you choose Mexico? Because some of our patients wouldn't be able to do that. Why not a hospital in London?
Well, to answer the second part first, I chose Mexico because the London hospital appeared to me not to be able to offer me anything that would help. I found myself in the hands of a man who, as a consultant, was very, very highly regarded. He's since been knighted since that time. That's why. I realized that his diagnosis was probably about as accurate as could be made, that if I'd gone to someone else for a second opinion, they would have sent the stuff to the same labs that he used and come back with the same results and probably the same prognosis. So I needed to do something different, and the only wheel in town that I knew about was this Mexican clinic. And fortunately, I was able to afford to get there and to do it. It wasn't by most measures all that expensive. I mean, it did cost us the airfares, and one had to pay for the hospital, but it was, well, I mean, I had a choice to live and die, and rather than die, I would have, you know, been happy to sell every last bit of my worldly possessions in order to save my own life. I'd worry about how to survive once I got past that initial crisis. Fortunately, I didn't have to do that. My background is such I was able to afford to do it without a great deal of strain. My background involves, as does Anna's, for about the last 15 or 16 years, actively being involved in what's called the transformation movement. Spirituality, some of the new psychologies, participating in that world both as students and as teachers and as helpers and just involved in our own psychic spiritual unfoldment. Before that, I used to fancy myself an intellectual. Discovered that was not really all by itself worthwhile. Does that answer the question?
Which leads me on to the third part, was did you have any healing? There seems to be...
Healing meaning spiritual...
Hands.
Yes.
Which is very popular.
Yeah.
With a lot of patients. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask, did you actually experience
it? Yes. Quite a bit, actually. During the initial stages, not a lot directly, a small amount. One of the things that both Anna and I have been involved with for about a dozen years is a group of people who do something called attunement. And attunement is similar to spiritual healing, but less specifically intentional. In other words, the healer or the person who's offering the attunement doesn't set out to cure anything. It simply sets out to create an attunement with larger invisible cycles. I mean, they can be described in a variety of ways. I had a lot of that during the whole course of treatment, both from individuals who offered it to me. Anna offered it to me a bit when we were on our own in the hospital. There was a friend who came down a couple of times in the hospital and offered it to me. Then after I left the hospital, we remained in Southern California because I had to go back every four weeks for rounds of chemotherapy. And during the in-between time, we stayed in a spiritual community in Southern California where I had it every day. And I think that played a very large role. There was also a group some distance away who was involved with long distance attunement. They had me on their list. And a girlfriend of ours in London, who was an evangelical Christian, had me on her church's prayer list. And I don't know a soul in the church other than her, but I mean, this is whatever works, I'm happy to go along with. So I mean, I had a lot of, call it invisible support beyond what Anna and I were doing together in the hospital. And I think that it's an important point because, I mean, one may believe in that sort of thing or not. I don't think it makes a lot of difference. What does make a difference is that there is a body of agreement that participates somehow or another with the patient in strengthening them, in giving them greater energy, I suppose, to overcome the illness, whatever it is. I know in amongst AIDS groups, particularly one in California, where there's a large group, a support group, made up largely of AIDS patients, helpers, friends of AIDS patients, and people who are just deeply involved in the whole thing, that centers around a woman called Louise Hay. And Anna's just brought this book along. We found it rather useful. It's called You Can Heal Your Life. She's done some quite seemingly miraculous work with AIDS patients, people who, again, have been condemned to, you know, a few weeks or months to live, who are now alive 2, 3, 4 years later. Some of them, they claim, and I don't know how true it is, but it sounds, I'm hearing these reports more often now from various friends, that some of them, the virus seems to have pretty well vanished. And some of them have been symptom-free for some months now. So maybe AIDS isn't 100% a killer. There may be other aspects to it that are just beginning to emerge, which is very hopeful. But this book, which you can buy here, it's a very, very spiritually oriented book. It's called You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. It's published in America. I've seen it, actually this is an English edition, so I know it can be bought here. This is our only, this.
Yes.
She takes an extremely spiritual approach. I mean, there's some things in there that even though I'm very open to that very invisible world side of life, I find rather hard to accept. But it's proved very successful. And her work has made her into something of a media celebrity there, too, simply because she's been so successful. So there's a lot more going on in these things than meets the eye, I think. Mm-hmm. I'll let you moderate.
Sorry.
Abby's case, you had a full treatment of what we call conventional medicine, as well as all these additional help and support that you got.
Nutrition.
How much do you think that perhaps contributed to the final result? I mean, I'm sure your well-being, certainly the continued regression is probably due to your own inner powers, but I would imagine that the liquid catheter and what went into it was probably partly important.
Well, it was. I have a letter from the original consultant who, what I did was I wrote letters along the way back to my GP in Gloucestershire telling him what was going on, and he would send those letters on to the consultant in London. And I have a letter from the consultant to the GP saying he's most surprised, he hopes the reports are true, and that the 5-FU by itself would be effective in no more than 20% of cases. So he'd given me 50-50. The truth of the matter was it was 80% against me. Now, I mean, I can sit and I can say that, yes, maybe if I'd stayed in London, the 5-FU all by itself would have worked and I wouldn't have needed to do all of this. But I think if I'd done that and it had worked, I would have missed out on an awful lot of very, very valuable experience that makes it a lot less likely to reoccur.
The doctors are really, the doctors in Mexico, and this is why there are so many clinics along there, their trill is something that they think is very vital to their treatment. And that's not acceptable here or in America. You can't use Laetril. Although we brought some Laetril back with us from Tijuana last year, the year before, when we came back after we'd been away 6 months, 7 months. And the doctor was extremely kind. He said, whatever you've been doing, if it works, let's keep on. So he arranged for Dom to continue having the same type of chemotherapy and the Laetril at the same time. But it isn't that medication you can't use officially here. I think you can bring it in, but you can't get it. The hospitals won't use it. And that was another reason why we went to Mexico. Not that we think that all alone it's the answer, but the holistic approach, using all these different approaches and as gentle chemotherapy as possible, and spaced rather than all at once, and the diet, enzymes, what else did you have?
All sorts of things. They used a lot of, I had pancreatic enzymes in conjunction with the Laetril, and they work together. It's quite a complex theory about what's supposed to happen, but it seems to have some effect when it's administered by people who believe that it's going to have some effect.
We used to use Laetril here.
Did you?
But it's been banned now. We can't. Mainly because of its toxic effect. And I personally have actually seen some very, very toxic effects from it. But given intravenously, I think maybe if yours is going into the liver, this might have made a difference.
Yeah. Well, I had it intravenously too. I mean, and they give it with none at all. Nor is there doesn't seem to be much literature. I've seen in Tijuana they've compiled a complete bibliography on Laetril. And in it, the toxicity factor, which has always been suspected because it is a compound of cyanide, seems to be very, very rare. I mean, there are so few cases of any toxicity that they hardly seem to account for anything. It's interesting if you've actually seen some. It may depend on the source of the material.
The state of the patient.
The state of the patient, possibly, because I mean, the release of the cyanide is so little. People who've gone ahead and eaten lots of apricot kernels have often got quite ill. That's true, but that's because they don't. It's an impure form of the stuff. I suffered no toxicity from it, and I was taking quite big doses. I mean, something like 6 grams intravenously 3 times a week at the end of the time, giving it to myself. And of course, it was going right into my bloodstream. A lot less toxic than the 5-FU. That's the other thing. I mean, there was diet, there was that. The Laetril in conjunction with diet and the pancreatic enzymes was a very important combination. I mean, Laetril all by itself, no one said it would do much. But it was that combination. The diet had to be very low protein. That's the whole theory behind Laetril, is that it affects the protein coating on the tumor cells and reveals them to the immune system.
Could I just ask a question? I mean, I don't know that much about this particular area. I'm wondering, when you said about your diet, the detoxification, that had an effect on your response to chemotherapy. Your hair didn't fall out and so on. I wonder, picking up on Elizabeth's point, you know, that maybe the administration without dietary consideration will have side effects in that way. Maybe your diet, as it helped you with your chemotherapy, was helping with the allergy.
Well, it was more than the diet. It was the diet, it was that Dr. Contreras Sr. feels that the Laetrile in conjunction with the 5-FU reduces the side effects. He doesn't know why, but he says that's been his experience. The whole thing, I mean, first of all, 5-FU, I discovered people don't, as a rule, lose their hair from. What normally happens is they get awful ulcers in their mouth, stomatitis. And I did eventually, towards the last round or so of that, begin to get some small mouth ulcers that were mildly uncomfortable, and I was quite happy to have that happen in return for the tumor going away. But that was the worst of it. Most of the other, I mean, I read through the whole literature on 5-FU, and for one, as one of the milder cytotoxics, it's pretty horrific when you read through the potential side effects. And
So when chemotherapy is used, it obviously really hammers at the immune system, which is already very low. And I feel that there's a lot that can be done through nutrition and other things to build up the immune system. I feel that diet is important for that, as well as exercise and fresh air. And this was an area that we, you know, when we came back, and obviously were a long way away from our doctors, from Don's doctors, we had to have a good think about how to carry on the good work and what we could do to enhance the medication. And it seemed to come back to what we could do to build up the immune system, Don's immune system again. Because when he did catch any infection, he really got it badly. Like, he got chicken pox.
Yeah, tell about that.
Just about 6 months after the cancer thing. And I mean, the poor thing, he was covered in chicken pox, huge ones all over. He got it much worse than one would normally.
Well, it was childhood chicken pox. Yes. It wasn't even proper shingles or anything like adults are supposed to get. It was good old-fashioned chicken pox.
Yeah, and then when you got colds and fevers later, it was always much worse. So we realized that the immune system was the key at the physical level, and everything we could do, you know, in healing to strengthen the immune system was going to make a long-term difference.
I also found, by the way, just as another aside in this business, is that a few times, first of all, during that December, around Christmas time, 86, after the initial course of treatment, and I went back to California considerably improved, I came down with some kind of a very high fever, highest fever I'd ever had. I mean, I had temperatures of 106 or more. And everyone was quite concerned, including me. But it was, in a way, I felt after the fact like those high fevers had helped the whole process, that somehow that they burned up the remaining tumor activity. Mm-hmm. And since then, I came across some literature that back early in the century, they were actually inducing fever in cancer patients. And there was a lot of good theoretical grounds for this. And for some reason, it was one of those things that got lost in the shuffle of new drugs and other newer techniques. And even more recently, I've read that some doctors have revived the practice. There's a particular bacteria, I don't know what it is, that they can inject into you and induce a high fever. And apparently it does have some good anti-neoplastic, as they call it, effects. So, I mean, some of these fevers turned out to be fortuitous and very helpful, too.
Wrap me up in cotton wool and take care of me and not allow me to do the things for myself. Did you find that a problem?
Yeah. At one point, I loved it. When I was feeling so weak and rotten, I was happy to give myself over to anyone and anything. But there came an interesting moment in the way when I was beginning to get a little bit of strength back. I was beginning to feel much more positive about my own future. And Anna had taken such care of me that there were moments when I felt she didn't want to let go that easily. And I said to you, I mean, we had the conversation, I said, please, because now I need my self-respect back. I need you to start stepping back a little bit from that, and which she did, you know, recognized and did that immediately. I don't like being cared for too much. I mean, the child in me liked it, and the adult in me hated it. And the adult in me came out on top, as it were, and got me back to the point where I could look after myself to some extent. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I'd always been conscious that you needed an empowering. And it's back to this thing about the roles we play, you know, mother and child. And it's too easy if you have a sick husband or... I mean, there is a time when you need to care for them in a way they can't care for themselves. But to go on caring as if a husband's a child and not make his be responsible for his own life decisions, I mean, that cuts away at the roots of things. So, yeah, I think I'd been conscious that I needed to empower you, as you hadn't had much power for a long time. And also then I had to handle my own thoughts and feelings about it and whether I was, you know, taking on more than I needed at that stage. So it seemed to be quite a natural thing, and I was glad we could actually talk about it before there were, you know,
serious problems. Yes,
again,
sir.
Or
yes.
Too many.
How much of your treatment are you undergoing?
No, I do practice the imagery from time to time, actually, when I think of it. The actual treatment, I still take a certain, I take oral Laetrile, small maintenance amount. I take the enzymes orally. Back during the treatment, the enzymes were given rectally. I take lots of vitamin C and various other supplements, including selenium and L-methionine, which were touted as being liver protectors. They were amongst the things that I was given then. Now, that's about it. And I do that just sort of as a maintenance dose. I do take large amounts of vitamin C regularly. I take as much as 6 grams a day.
Are there any other aspects of your sort of life, I would call it life routine or what have you, that have, if you like, permanently changed having been through this process? I could see that perhaps one could go through a crisis like this and then resume one's living as before, but I sense the fact that you haven't done that.
Well,
some things have changed and not gone back.
I mean, that's the most dangerous. I said the most dangerous part of the whole thing is when you start getting better. And then all these good things that you've learned, you get lost in the old habits. But maybe you could say what seems to have changed more than I can. I mean, I know there have been, but I'd be hard-pressed to...
Are you ready for it? Well, he's a much happier man than he was. He enjoys every day. Nearly every day, most of the minutes of the day. He still grumbles a bit. He was pretty miserable for a long time. Very chose a very isolated sort of lifestyle. He'd begun to write, and he'd got a word processor. And I think this was a substitute for human relationships a lot of the time. He'd got his head down. And
laughing because I just bought one.
Well, watch out. Watch out. But, I mean, yeah, I'm sure they have a place like any other useful tool, a vacuum cleaner or a typewriter, but don't give it too much importance.
At one point you were about to name the word processor as correspondent of the divorce.
Yes. But he, more seriously, he was pretty nasty at times. And I guess now I'd say because he couldn't articulate what he was feeling. And he didn't know what he was feeling. Also, I think when he was writing, he was probably taking on some of his characters a little bit too strongly and couldn't let them go at the end of the day. So we had them all living with us too. So, I mean, that's just putting in context. He became much gentler. I was going to say yielded, but that's a funny word because you have funny ideas about it. But yeah, I more sort of more yielded into a process instead of trying to figure it all out here. And over the last 2 years or so, what is it, 2.5 years? You're much, you talk about your feelings a little bit more easily rather than letting things bottle up and then explode. You have let go of a lot of resentment and bitterness. Yeah, I mean, he's...
question is, am I more radiant after
yes,
all?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to get into. Yes, I'd say the answer
really?
To that is yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. Most of the time.
On a more mundane level.
Sorry?
Also on a more mundane level. I mean, have you changed the way you end up living? Have you changed your diet in some sort of sense?
I've changed my diet in some sense. I haven't actually changed the way I'm living too much, other than the fact that in many ways I've slowed down in certain areas. I've become less involved in some things that I considered very important before I was ill, and now seem to me not very important at all. But a lot of priorities, internal priorities, shifted. I was very involved with the management and as an executive with a large charitable group, and always was rather cross at how badly they were behaving by my standards. And I've sort of withdrawn a lot of that kind of relationship with the group, and just allowing them to get on with it and realizing that, you know, I can contribute to it, but I don't have to have the whole show conform to my values. There are more important things for me to do than be judge and jury.
I think you listen to people much more easily than you used to. You listen to other people's points of view. Mm-hmm. He's more receptive in that way. I mean, in our relationship, I find he's much easier. It's much easier. He doesn't cut me off so much or other people. And you're more willing to share the attention and the... Well, even like a day like this, I can come in if I feel I have something to say, and you don't sort of push me aside in the same way. And that goes with other people. You are much more receptive.
Yeah, in that way. And in terms of diet, yes, I mean, I changed certain aspects of my diet. I was lucky, for me anyway, when I got into this form of treatment, diet is a very central part. Most of the people were put on what was called a strict laetrile diet, which was virtually, well, almost entirely a vegetarian diet, or even nearly vegan, as dairy products were kept at a minimum. I wasn't, because I was so weak and emaciated they wanted to build me up. And so I was put on what was known as the modified laetrile diet, which allowed me fish and chicken and a few things on the odd eggs. And I thrived on it, and so they never took me off it. So I didn't have to change my eating habits that radically. But I did have to cut down on some of the excessive things I was doing. I was an excessive cheese eater, peanut butter eater, and chocolate eater. I drank a lot of coffee. Well, not a lot of coffee, but much more than I do today. And what else did I give up? Cigarettes, of course. I mean, that's probably the major shift after 40 years of smoking cigarettes, or pretty nearly 40 years of smoking cigarettes. Which actually reminds me, that's another thing, which I'm trying to write a book about this whole experience now, and a central issue which I haven't mentioned was old beliefs. Funny things that you pick up in childhood that have had a major effect upon this entire thing. One was that I started smoking at about age 14. In those days in California, one could drive a car to and from school at that age with a student license, it was called. I mean, ridiculous, but there I was. And of course, I had the privacy to be able to smoke. You know, no one could see me when I was in the car. My parents couldn't see me anyway. And so I began this awful habit then. And one or two people would say, even back then in 1950, that smoking will cause cancer. And I would say, oh yes, but I mean in 20 years' time they'll have a cure for it, and it takes at least 20 years for a cancer to develop, which seemed to be the wisdom of the time. And so I needn't worry about it because they'll be able to cure it by the time I get it. And I really believed that. I mean, it started out as a childish sort of excuse or justification. But in fact, if smoking was a major causal factor, which I think it must have been, I was convinced that it could be cured somehow. I'd never had this idea in my mind that cancer was totally incurable that many people have. I'd also heard a joke when I was 13 or 14, a rather bad joke, which was something, it went something like, whatever happened to Harry? And they said, oh, he died. And they said, but I just saw him. I said, oh yes, well, it was a mild case and he recovered. And that joke had struck me as particularly funny. And I giggled about it, I remember, for months at the time, and I kept repeating it over and over again to other people, sort of telling it as my own joke. And it stayed with me all these years, of having a mild case of death and recovering from it. And I think that programmed me in a funny way, that as near to death as I was, that I could recover from it. And I think there are probably lots of funny things that I don't even recall consciously anymore that happened in childhood that allowed me to believe at a deep level that I didn't have to die from the causes that a lot of other people feel they have to or believe they have to die from. Those are some of the things.
Something that I was been thinking during this last bit of the conversation. I know I'm pretty safe in saying it here, but I think that Don got much more in touch with his feminine side. You know, if you're going to say there's masculine and feminine, and through this illness, he's much more accepting of that side of himself and incorporating it and expressing it. And less having to be in charge of the whole show. But I won't go on because that's one of my favourite topics.
You can do another day.
Can I ask how you changed?
Mm-hmm.
Because you mentioned that you
changed. How I changed? I might turn that over to Dawn in a minute. But, like I said earlier, I feel more self-confident. My life for the last 15 years has seemed validated once I became involved in healing or another way of looking at life and expressing it. I feel much less anxious more relaxed. Part of that's being heard by Don, by yourselves now, perhaps, relates to what he was saying about attention earlier. I think that we all need the right sort of attention somewhere in our lives. And if we haven't had that positive, nourishing attention when we're young, perhaps we grow up with certain distortions. And that I really value now the quality of listening as a means for healing, a means for love, what I would call radiant listening, perhaps active listening, which I've learned probably to do some more, and I've certainly received that. So that allows your real self, perhaps, to be heard, to blossom. And perhaps that's what's happened for me more than previously. I'm more able to come out of myself. And I enjoy life a great deal. And I'm very glad to have a much happier marriage than before. But I think these things come along, they're like a big kick in the pants if you're not doing what you need to. You know, life has a way of pushing you, and you can accept that challenge or not. No,
I think you said it. Basically, it's just a very different kind of confidence that you seem to have in yourself, and that you do have in yourself, and a sense of authority that's come from having proved out a lot of things that used to be more theoretical.
It's a feeling.
Yeah. And, I think that's it. I think in a way we've both gained a certain sense of our own innate authority and potency.
Actually, I should say, we've also found it necessary to do some therapy together. We just did a couple of sessions last year and intend to do some more this summer, because having gone through all the illness side of things with a fruitful outcome, a successful outcome, it seemed to me that a lot of old patterns were beginning to come up again in our lives, and some of the tensions and difficulties and unresolved things, and so we've been addressing those together and with some help with another. I don't know if you found that useful. I certainly have. It's had to do with communication, actually. It's had to do with really learning how to listen, how to hear each other, and how to extend that to others, probably.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it's the communication and the self-understanding and through that the understanding of other people that's been very valuable.
Well, I think communication is a central issue in life in general, isn't it? We've all got to learn how to do that. And I believe now, having gone through this, that if we had been better communicators, and to communicate means also to be able to receive communication, to share. I mean, someone who I've been working with in a very different way recently, a philosopher, a scientist, talks about a shared content of consciousness, which allows creative fields to be opened and to be made available that wouldn't be in the normal course, where we never share the same content of consciousness, because we're always listening to the other person and saying, well, we agree with this, we don't agree with that. So we don't suspend that aspect of things. But that kind of open communication, I think, would probably help an awful lot of people to not get ill.
Yes, I think it's to do with feelings. I mean, when I was thinking about, okay, so what are we communicating? And part of it has to do with being able to communicate one's feelings, one's deeper feelings. First of all, one has to find out what those are. And it's like onion skins, like there are a lot of feelings which cover up and distort other feelings. It's like layers of maybe anger and fear and grief and shame and guilt. And underneath there, there's the healthy love. But if you're trying to hide behind all those things or not being honest at looking at them and dealing with them, you know, you're hiding behind the bushes, in a sense, and communicating those things. You're communicating fear and shame and guilt, and I think things like cancer and other things are symptoms, perhaps, of these unresolved feelings, because you don't know what you're really feeling and you don't know how to be received with those feelings. And I, by learning to express some feelings which A, I didn't know I had, B, I wouldn't allow myself to feel. But doing that in a safe way, realizing that at the depth that wasn't what I was really feeling, you know, they were the mask in a sense. And also, they were very often superimposed. They were learnt feelings, learnt thoughts from society, from parents, from, oh, who knows what. But to get to who you really are and be able to express that and your own true feelings makes a huge difference. Am I making sense? I don't know if you can understand.
Yes,
but,
yeah.
It's quite extraordinary sitting here listening to you. How I might almost be listening to a recovering alcoholic, which is a family illness, and the kind of program that you have chosen as your present way of life. It just seems to me adopting such a positive approach. What you said about cancer, how much of it has to be reduced. Also, you know, taking drugs or someone that takes alcohol is self-induced, but how much of it is due to our thinking and our way of life. And as in sort of AA, where you have your 12 steps of living, be it as yourself, relative of the person who is sick, you still have that same program to follow. It seems to me very, very important that the family is involved in any, and this is something I find very difficult to, I'm very new in this sort of field, and I've been working in hospital. 6 months. And you see families who don't know how to come to terms, or how even to talk about their father or their husband or their mother has cancer. What do you do? I mean, I'm a very lonely auxiliary nurse who sits in the background, doing what I can as far as I'm able, as a person, not just as a non-human. How can I help? Where do I go to? Or what do I do to acquire perhaps the skills that you have of being able to communicate?
Well, listening is a huge help, I think. Anyone who will give their whole, you know, their real attention, be there with someone else and listen and not judge. So make that safe space, that atmosphere, for the other one to sort of say what's in their heart. And also, if one can communicate what's going on with you, I think that also makes, you know, what your feelings are, where you are, that makes a bond, a healing momentum, perhaps. I mean, yes, there's more, but I think someone who really listens and receives you is very, that's very empowering, that's very, very healing.
You can do more good than a yes. world of expertise.
Be a real friend, really.
I think that's what people crave, I mean, when they're ill, is someone who they can talk to without someone saying, they're there, it's all right, you know, or that's rubbish, or something of that nature, but who really listen to them respectfully and allow them to open their hearts. That there can be no greater healing process than that when someone is distressed. And it's a rare commodity in this world that we live in, that there's someone around who will listen to us and we really want to open.
Can I just add something to that? And maybe it's important that we're aware that we don't have to have the answers. One of the things I'm hearing you saying is that when we're talking about communication and painful issues, is to actually just sit with someone and say, I don't have the answers, but I will actually sit with you and share your exploration or share. Mm. I mean, that's what I'm actually hearing as part of your process.
Not try and fix it up in any
way. Right, make it better.
Yes. Mm. You don't have to make it better.
For myself, the key is also to know what you are feeling yourself. And I think that whole normal aspect that you were talking about earlier, about fitting into a role and taking your responses and initiatives from the external world, that addictive pattern, is also something that professionals and I probably have caught up in on levels that perhaps a very similar. And I think the process that you've both been involved in, if I had to look at the words that you chose to talk about today and analyze the tape, I got a sense that there would be a category, a line down the middle, which would be words that were very receiving, receptive, taking in. Maybe even childlike, the ones receiving. But it was balanced by action, perhaps inherent initiatives towards help, in which somehow organically the people that you needed to be in contact with and the influences that had to be near you were made available by an invisible force. For lack of a better descriptive word. And I think for myself, someone in the arts, I question whether we have to know what we're feeling, or even if we are feeling all the time, that perhaps we're not. And it's very, very, it's a question that I have as to what kind of process one would need to be aware of for oneself, to be doing the work, the internal work that makes one not reactive to the external world, but really reactive to one's own, or responsive to one's true initiatives and authority as the word you use.
I started thinking about trust this morning and about the experience, and that when you start moving in the right direction, a sort of healing, a healthy direction, the world then, or what's outside then validates you. You do receive and meet the people you need to at that point. And I don't know how it happens, it seems magical at times, but it definitely happens. So you receive the sort of validation that you are moving in a direction and that the universe is benign because everything in it is there to help you. Everyone you meet, every next step seems very natural and a natural unfoldment without one actually having to do a lot. Like, you know, you don't have to manipulate it much, it seems. It's all there. And that, there's this sort of symbiotic thing that goes on. It reinforces one's trust and assurance. And there are questions being asked all the time. I mean, there's a as to how life works, really. And then, but you have to trust and be able to step out. And every step, it's like I have the experience of guidance, really. It's the only way I could think of putting it. Not from anything as glamorous as a I'm not a channel that I know of, anything like that. But just that the people that one needs and the qualities that one needs are there. They come along at the right time. And also one has to take some risks to get out of old patterns and into new ones and be able to say, I don't know. I don't know, for instance, what you were saying about feelings, you know, whether feelings are actually the guide. Because it isn't feelings on their own and it isn't thinking on their own. Those are very useful indications of what's happening, information sometimes. They're more like channels, more like tools, and there's a and you need to be able to hear them and use them in the right way. And there's still something unknown that is there taking care of you.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to be a bit like a TV producer, but I'm getting signals like 5 and so on, which relates to the meal. So I think we actually have to draw this session to a close. At the end of this morning, I've actually heard what I wanted to hear. I've heard again, when my first visit to listening to Don and Anna, and I hope that you've heard the same as myself, and would like to join with me in saying a big thank you to Don and Anna for joining us this morning.
Luncheon will be served, I guess, in about a quarter of an hour when they do this special trick of changing those tables round and magical food appearing there. So we can just break and as I said, we'll probably be back in the room in about 10-15 minutes.